As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Chelsea's difficult season continued as Mauricio Pochettino's side were held to a 2-2 draw by 10-man Burnley at the weekend.
Swung in towards O'Shea!
There's division among the fans, a £1 billion squad yet to gel, and growing pressure on the manager. So can Chelsea salvage something from their remaining games? And after all the instability this season, will there be another summer of sweeping change? I'm Ayo Kimolere. Welcome to the Athletic FC podcast. Okay, joining us today to talk about events at Stamford Bridge, we have The Athletic's Tim Spears and also our Chelsea writer, Liam Toomey, who is also part of another podcast on this network, Straight Out of Cobham. Liam, let's start with you on this Burnley 2-2 at Stamford Bridge. Manager Mauricio Pochettino is talking about the team's lack of hunger. I mean, that's never good for a manager to say, is it?
Yeah, and it's also striking because you can probably count on one hand the number of times that Pochettino has called out his players. He's defended them even when no one else has this season. That seems to have been his, I think that's his style as a coach anyway, but it's certainly been his approach with this young group to kind of put his arms around them and act as the lightning rod for criticism from the outside rather than turning the fire on them. But I think even he felt that there wasn't any defending what Chelsea did. I mean, there wasn't any defending on the pitch from Chelsea against 10-man Burnley. And to contrive to concede twice against 10 men that may well be bound for the championship. My colleague Simon Johnson wrote that it was one of the most disappointing results of the season. It's hard to dispute that given the context.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about a player that has had quite mixed feelings from Chelsea fans in particular, Raheem Sterling. But actually, you look at the profile of that squad, probably one of the most experienced players on that squad, the most experienced player on that squad other than Thiago Silva, Tim. What do we make of his season so far?
Really mixed. He started the season quite well, didn't he? And I kind of felt like he was making himself very pickable for England, but then his form seemed to drop off before Christmas. And I feel like with the problems that have gone on around him, he hasn't dealt with that too well. I feel like the weight of expectation being on his shoulders doesn't suit him that well. He's a player who looks like he doubts himself to me. You can kind of see angst and nerves on his face sometimes. He obviously had that horrible moment against Leicester. A couple of weeks ago, I've never seen a player booed for being just bad and like such an awful free kick before. It was a horrible moment. I had a lot of sympathy for him actually, but he's always been capable of that. He used to miss the most amazing sitters at City. He's always done that, but he's always sort of had the character to bounce back. I think there are perceptions about him that are wrong. I think people wrongly think that he's selfish. I don't think that's true at all. I just think that maybe branching out to Chelsea hasn't been the best move for him. He's often been better as part of a collective. You look at his early days at Liverpool with Suarez and Sturridge and Gerrard, or at City with Aguero and Mahrez and Sane and Silva and De Bruyne and whoever else. Yeah, the more expectation solely on his shoulders perhaps hasn't suited him. And then obviously he's going to be compared to someone much younger than him in Cole Palmer, who's sort of propping Chelsea up and has become the talisman that they wanted Sterling to be, and has done it with a real, with what looks like a real calmness and effortlessness, and has taken that leadership on his shoulders in a way that I think Chelsea fans hoped Sterling would, but it looks like he hasn't.
Yeah, Liam, I just don't want to pick him up for the sake of it. I, you know, the reason Chelsea are where they are is not because of Raheem Sterling. It's fair to say that what's expected of him here, with a team that doesn't quite know what's going on versus what was expected from him at Manchester City, is very, very different. So can we understand that fans perhaps just have a bit more patience, because collectively this is a Chelsea problem, not a Raheem Sterling problem?
Yeah, it is. And I think if you sit a lot of those Chelsea fans down individually and talk to them, they would understand that and they would articulate it in some form or another. But when they're in the stand and they're in a group, I think it's been a thing with football fans generally, not just the Chelsea thing. I think we've seen it with England. We've seen it with some of Sterling's previous clubs. Even at City, where he was broadly liked, he's a uniquely frustrating player to watch at times, because while I think he's got very good technique generally, he has an unfortunate habit of that technique deserting him at key moments. You know, he can make really bad decisions in the final third, or miss a pass that he should make, or miss a chance that, you know, he really should score. But he doesn't hide. That's the thing. We talk about Sterling's mental strength. For better or worse, he doesn't hide. And I think we saw that again against Burnley. He's on the bench to start the game. He comes on, absolutely wonderful assist for Cole Palmer. Brilliant flick around the corner. You know, we talk about the comparison with Palmer that kind of damns him in terms of their performances this season. But, you know, he's someone who helped Palmer settle when he arrived at Chelsea. Palmer's always looked at him as a big brother. And I think that informed the penalty discussion and the way that went, the penalty discussion that so infuriated Chelsea fans. I think that was a particularly damaging moment for Sterling, because there was a way you could interpret that, or the most obvious interpretation of that was leaning into the perception of Sterling as selfish, that, you know, he wanted that moment, he wanted it to be about him rather than the team. I didn't interpret it that way, because, you know, within the context of Sterling's career, it makes more sense to think, and I've had conversations since that have backed up my feelings on this, that he's trying too hard, that he's tying himself in knots, trying to be the player that he thinks he should be. I mean, he arrived at Chelsea talking about winning the Ballon d'Or, and he wasn't joking. You know, even if people might have been laughing on the outside, he has to have that sense of belief in himself. And also, he has to live up to the expectations around him. And here we come back to the price Chelsea paid for him from Manchester City, even more so the contract that they gave him, which now jars horribly with the deals they did from January 2023 onwards, with this low base salary, you know, incentivized contracts, young players. He's on this massive guaranteed salary that is not scaled based on whether Chelsea are in Europe or not. Fans know that. And so that's something that informs the criticism that he gets inside Chelsea, but a lot more so outside Chelsea.
As I said earlier, you know, he's one of the oldest in the team. He's got so much experience. He's won so many trophies. He's won the Premier League various times. He has to be integral to what Chelsea want to do this season. I don't want us to look too far ahead. If we think about this season in particular, if those players around the field are looking for someone to look up to, for me, it's either him or Thiago Silva, surely, based on experience and just what they've done in their careers.
Yeah, and it's not Thiago Silva at the moment. And, you know, you look at that Chelsea team with its young average age and its players who are sort of drowning really in expectations and negative atmospheres and all sorts of things that are going wrong there. And yeah, you'd expect Sterling to be one of the ones that needs to step up. I mean, he's 29 now, as you say. He's been there, he's done it. He's won 80 caps for England. He's scored at Euros and World Cups and in massive games and won huge trophies. And yeah, for all that you can have a little bit of sympathy for him for some of the things that Liam said there, I do think we can rightly expect a little bit more from him.
Let's move on to Mauricio Pochettino. His contract's up next year. I think he's got a year left on it. the situation, we get a sense, might be reviewed over the summer, Liam. What impact will, you know, that semi-final against Manchester City have on his future? If Chelsea managed to win that, you'd like to think that puts him in good stead for an extension, surely.
Well, it can't hurt him. It would be the signature result of his tenure. You know, really the best performances and best results of Pochettino's time as Chelsea coach have been draws. Against City, against Arsenal, against Liverpool on the opening day. So we know that this team is capable of raising themselves for a higher standard of opposition. And we know that in those circumstances, Pochettino is capable of devising game plans that fit the occasion and the opponent. So you couldn't write them off. They will be heavy underdogs against Manchester City. But I don't think, on the whole, that the domestic cups are going to move the needle massively in terms of the evaluation of Pochettino. The bottom line is Chelsea expected to be significantly higher up the league than they are. And there are many, many reasons for that, many of which Pochettino tries to point out on a weekly basis. We'll talk about the injuries. Ultimately, I think he will be judged on not just that base league position, but a bigger sense of, is this team moving in the right direction? Are there reasons to be optimistic beyond where Chelsea are in the table? Are players individually developing? Are they collectively building relationships that can take them to a higher level in the long term? Because it's not always easy to see, you know, in Arteta's first couple of years at Arsenal, and this is the example that I think Chelsea have leaned on a lot in these painful 18 months. It's not always immediately apparent that a leap is coming before it happens. But I think the worry you'd have about Chelsea right now, and the probably the most damaging thing for Pochettino this season, you know, he said recently, if you look at the data, we should be fourth. That was true at one point. I don't think it's true now. And the main reason why it's not true now is because this is the worst defensive team of my lifetime. At Stamford Bridge, this is a terrible defensive Chelsea team. Burnley was their fifth consecutive game conceding two goals, and their opponents in that time, the best team they've played, were Newcastle, a heavily depleted Newcastle. So they just don't keep clean sheets. They give themselves far too much work to do in attack, and they make far too many mistakes. And that's why ultimately I'm not sure you can see them winning the FA Cup. And if Chelsea decide to move on from Pochettino in the summer, that will probably be high on the list of reasons why.
Tim, I can't help but think, you know, is this an impossible job anyway for anybody? I mean, look at all the new arrivals. And I know we've talked about this several times, but I keep asking myself, how hard is it to have a completely new squad, very few leaders in there, very few recognisable faces from, you know, a team that's won a lot over the last few seasons? I mean, what are they expecting a coach like that to do?
Yeah, but is it not a manager's dream to be given a squad with the talent that he's had at his disposal? You know, people like Moises Caicedo, one of the most promising young DMs in world football, or Enzo Fernandez, you know, a gifted midfielder and a World Cup winner, or, you know, Mudryk. The whole of Europe was looking at Mudryk, an incredibly talented forward with huge potential, you know, but also good enough right now. Just needs unlocking a little bit with a bit of confidence. You know, that's what a manager would want, right? And a manager would also request a bit of time to work with that squad. And obviously he had pre-season and he's had no European football this year, so plenty of time on the training ground. I think that's a big mark against him. So I don't know. I disagree with that, to be honest. I know he's been unlucky with injuries, and I think you can have sympathy for him on that front, particularly with someone like Reece James. You know, we talk about a lack of maybe influential figures in the squad. You know, they really obviously miss him in terms of a character, but also his huge short source of output. But that argument weakens, A, when you look at the size of the squad, and B, when you look at how other squads have coped with injuries this season. Arguably, everybody's done it better than Chelsea have. You know, you look at Newcastle down to their last 11 senior players in December in Paris and taking PSG to the 95th minute, and then losing with a, you know, really unjust penalty to Kylian Mbappe, or Spurs going to Man City with a centre-back pairing of Emerson Royale and Ben Davis and missing half their team and still drawing 3-3 away at Man City. Or you look at, yeah, Liverpool winning a cup final against Chelsea with, forget the average age argument, but a lot of young, untested, fringe squad players. So Yeah, there's less and less in Pochettino's defence, to be honest. I think he's got a job that a lot of managers would crave, and he's not done a very good job.
Do you buy that, Liam? He's got a job that a lot of managers would crave.
Well, we might find out this summer if it's a job that other coaches would crave, because I think every year removed that Chelsea are from European football, the more difficult it becomes for these owners, the co-sporting directors, Lawrence Stewart and Paul Winstanley, to pitch the best coaches or even the best young coaches in Europe that Chelsea is the right place for them to build their careers or build a special team. I think, without wanting to make too many excuses for Pochettino, because I do think there are legitimate grounds to criticise him this season, the injury situation goes beyond luck. Like, this is a permanent, endless injury crisis. Chelsea, it's become a standing joke with the fan base, albeit not a funny one, that the weekly injury update published on Chelsea's app and website, it's begun to resemble an Athletic long read. It's absolutely crazy. They always have 10 players injured. And the effect of that is twofold, really. One, obviously you don't have those players, and there are some key players in that list, you know, Reece James, Ben Chilwell, Christopher Nkunku, who would have been in Chelsea's best 11. They've just barely been factors this season. But the other effect is that the minutes load it's put on the players that are available and have been available. The fact that Romeo Lavia has just been a nothing for 53 million this year, he's the guy who would have been rotated in for Enzo. Instead, Enzo's just had to play every game, including when he's just 36 hours removed from flying back from South America for an international break. Leslie Okechukwu being out has meant Moises Caicedo's had to play every game. And I think that's had a massive impact on Chelsea, particularly in recent weeks, just not being able to press teams as well as Pochettino wants them to, because their midfield is gassed in the second half. They can't run. I don't think that's an excuse. I think that's one of the reasons, one of many reasons, why Chelsea are in this situation. And the fact that Pochettino was building his attack around Christopher Nkunku in pre-season, only for him to just not be there for most of this year, has been a big thing as well. So I think at full strength, this squad would have had still a challenge, the way the league has played out, to make top four, because there are three exceptional teams at the top of this league and another three very good ones. But with those 10 players out, I think it was always impossible for Chelsea to be in the hunt for Champions League qualification. Where you can criticise Pochettino is, should they be in the bottom half? Should they be mired in mid-table? Should they be nowhere near Europa League, which is where they are right now?
I guess we've probably answered it now. It's what, around 12 months since Graham Potter was sacked by Chelsea. Pochettino in, and the comparisons will always be made. Are Chelsea better off under this new manager than they were under Graham Potter? I mean, table standings, they're roughly equal. What do you reckon, Tim? And Liam, please jump in after this. Are Chelsea better off under Poch than Graham Potter?
It's an interesting question. The points and obviously the place in the table are very similar, but they're scoring an awful lot more goals. So I think it's like 20 more goals than this stage last season. But also, yeah, conceding a lot more, as Liam says, basically the worst defence in Chelsea's Premier League history. I don't know which one would you rather have, to be honest. Would you rather have a solid, boring team that can be built on and maybe bring in some firepower to score? Or would you rather have a team that can score goals but is utterly hapless and hopeless at the back? I don't know, splitting hairs, really. But when you're conceding, you know, two goals at home to Championship side Leicester and then another two at home to Championship bound Burnley. But then last season was so sort of insipid and lifeless and soulless, and people just wanted so much more from Potter. I think there's probably a little bit more promise in what we've seen this season from Pochettino. I think if you swap the managers round and you had Pochettino inheriting a squad with, you know, the sort of combined experience of Azpilicueta and Jorginho and Silva and Kovacic and Havertz and Mount, that would probably suit him better. And this situation would probably suit Graham Potter better, with younger players who need to be coached and relationships forged and developed and a philosophy imprinted slowly over a younger, with a younger squad. I think that would, I think if you swap them around a year, it'd probably work better. That's quite funny, isn't it? But Chelsea fans would be delighted with that. I don't know, Io. It's a great question. Who's better at finishing 11th, Potter or Pochettino?
Look, the data says, Liam, that Potter's got a higher win percentage than Graham Potter. But do you buy that? That actually Graham Potter might be suited better to this young squad than Pochettino, and maybe, you know, the Jorginhos of this world and Azpilicuetas of this world could really work well with a manager like Mauricio Pochettino.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought about it that way. I may pinch that, Tim, at some point in the next few weeks.
Just editing out the podcast and then just write an article on it to say it's your idea.
I think there might be something to that, certainly when you consider the dressing room dynamics. I think post-January, there's an argument that Chelsea's dressing room was just impossible post-January last year. There were too many players and there was this massive culture clash between these young guys that had come in and these older guys on bigger contracts who knew they either wanted to leave or they were going to be made to leave the following summer. And that created a mood that I think was just, Potter had no chance, Lampard had no chance when he came in. There was no collective spirit. Half the squad were checked out. That became the whole squad when they went out of the Champions League. And so that's why I think when we go into the season comparison, it's so strange for me, because while the league position is virtually identical, I think the story is completely different. Last season was the bleakest experience I've known in my time covering Chelsea, bleaker than the Hiddink interregnum after Mourinho's unravelling in 2015-16, because at least then you could see they had the core of a team that could compete for the Premier League again. Last season, scoring less than a goal a game. Chelsea fans will have preferred watching this season, because at least there have been good moments. At least you can enjoy Cole Palmer. At least Nicholas Jackson will do something every couple of games that makes you sit up and go, oh yeah, he's got something. You know, I think Chelsea fans sang Malo Gusto's name at Brentford a couple of weeks ago. It was kind of overshadowed by the other things they sang at Brentford. But there have been green shoots this year in a way that I don't think there have been last year. The question really is whether that is enough, whether those few green shoots are enough for Pochettino to make the argument that he deserves another season, another crack at this. As far as the win percentage goes, I think it can be a little bit deceptive, because I don't think cups should be included. Graham Potter, you know, you can make the argument as to whether he was a bad general. He certainly wasn't a lucky one. He drew Manchester City away in the third round of both cups. What chance have you got, really? Pochettino has had, I think, 50% of his games against teams outside the Premier League, below the Premier League, most of them at home in the Carabao Cup and FA Cup. So it was conducive to making deep runs. And fair play to him, he has. But like I said, I don't expect those cups to move the needle much. And we'll see whether these few player success stories can be enough for Pochettino to make the case that he deserves another season.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Something we started the pod on was talking about the fans. Well, last week, the Chelsea's fans advisory board criticised a letter released by Chelsea Supporters Trust, CST. Liam, can you just tell us a little bit more about that and just get a sense of what the conflict has been all about, please?
Yeah, so the Chelsea Supporters Trust published their correspondence with Chelsea, which was kicked off with a letter that they sent warning the club that a lack of open communication with the fan base about strategy of ownership, you know, on-field strategy, but the stadium, the match day experience, pricing, all sorts of things was leading to a lack of confidence in the ownership and, in their words, the risk of irreversible toxicity in the stands. Now, that's something we've already seen things sliding towards on Chelsea match days in the last couple of months. It always feels like they're about 20 minutes away from mutiny, certainly at away games when you've got the really hardcore supporters who make their voice heard. And so they sent this letter into Chelsea. Chelsea then responded via Chief Executive Chris Jurasek, despite the letter being addressed to Todd Boehly and Badade Bali. And Jurasek's response was what I would say very diplomatic, very political. It was quite vague, non-committal on things. Said all the right things about their desire for fan engagement without actually making any real assurances. And CST were not convinced by this. And so it's clear relations between CST and the club are not great. And then things took an unusual turn with the fan advisory board, which was set up by Boehly and Clearlake, with seven elected representatives of the fan base to try and ensure fan engagement, fan representation in the running of the club. They issued a public statement basically saying, I don't know what the CST are talking about. That hasn't been our experience at all. This toxicity, fans need to stick together. They even quoted Bob Marley, every little thing going to be all right, which, it's kind of over-egging what was a positive moment at the time for Chelsea at Selhurst Park a few weeks ago. It didn't play well in print, I don't think. So I think that was received and interpreted by a lot of Chelsea fans, particularly those in and around CST, as proving that the fan advisory board is essentially a puppet of the club and representing the club's viewpoint rather than representing the fans. Whether that's fair or not is another question, but I think that is a widespread perception among match-going supporters. And it's just not a healthy atmosphere right now. Fans don't trust the ownership to run the club in their interests, to run the club competently, because they look at the table, they look at the team slide into mediocrity. And I think things could only get worse if, as we all expect, Boehly and Clearlake put up season ticket prices in the next couple of months for next season. You know, it could be as much as 10% because those prices have been frozen for more than a decade under Abramovich. You can certainly make a capitalist argument they are underpriced given the market, but given where Chelsea are, it's a hard thing to pitch to the people that are forking out to watch them every week.
What can the club now do, which is obviously a business? Let's not forget this. We've spoken about this before. It is a business. What can the club now do to win sort of these fans back on side?
I mean, from an outsider point of view, I'd say some humility would go a long way. Some recognition that, you know, they've wasted 2 years, an awful lot of money, made a lot of mistakes, maybe give an idea of what the plan is and where they want to go and how they want to get there. You know, when you look at where they were winning the Champions League 3 years ago to what could be successive bottom half finishes in the Premier League, despite spending £1 billion, it's actually one of the biggest falls from grace in modern football history, if not the biggest. It's actually remarkable when you sit and think about how far they've fallen. And I know, Pochettino could talk about, we should be fourth, all he wants, and maybe a good run of results is just around the corner. But we've been saying that for a while, for almost two seasons now. So yeah, it's been an absolute disaster. The epitome of everything that's wrong with modern football. So they won't get much sympathy. They deserve the anger of their supporters. But, you know, ultimately they can erect a 100-foot banner saying we're sorry. Nothing improves the mood like results. You know, we saw this at Spurs a year ago, heading for eighth place, the first time they'd been outside of Europe in 15 years. You know, they'd go on to sell their greatest ever player, hugely unpopular owner, regular chance for Levy to go. And what did Spurs do? They put up season ticket prices, and they don't care. And they talked about the cost of living crisis, and they put prices up. And the only thing that changed the moods was results. And Postecoglou came in and completely changed the mood. The head coach came in and completely changed the mood of the whole club with a new style of football, an exciting brand of winning football. You know, only took two results in August, and Spurs fans were singing, "We've got our Tottenham back." And that's despite them paying more money to watch it and still hugely unpopular owners and still question marks over how the ownership are running the club. So it shows you how quickly things can change around. Ultimately, results are all that matters.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Right, Lynn, we talk about this multi-club model, which Bowley's Blue Co. are sort of part of. And, you know, one of the benefits of this, as we've seen perhaps with the City Group, who have now evolved into something different, is that when things are good, they are very good, you know. The teams around you are doing very well. Manchester City being sort of at the top of their pyramid. Now, you know, Burnley Blue Co. have got Strasbourg, and they've got a very similar problem with their fans that Chelsea have as well. It's clear to see that stuff just isn't quite going as they want it to go, considering all the incredible optimism that sat around many of these takeovers.
Well, the one thing they've managed to establish is it is incredible synergy and kinship between these two fan bases that didn't know each other before. They're, you know, Chelsea and Strasbourg are united in their disdain for Blue Co. at this point in time. Yeah, it is remarkable when you lay it out in the terms that Tim did, you know, just how badly these first 2 years have gone. for the investment that's been put in. Now, I still think if you would speak to the ownership, which of course is part of the problem, fans can't do that, they would make the argument that, you know, that they haven't written off the players they've bought. They're young players. They knew these were long-term investments. They've signed them on long contracts. They will judge the returns on those players over 7-8 years, not over two. But, and there's always this massive but, they did not expect these first 2 years to be anywhere near as painful as they've been. You know, I think in the first year, there was definitely an element of naivety of thinking they could come in, change everything on and off the pitch at lightning speed, basically erase every reminder of the Abramovich era, all that institutional knowledge, and still finish in the top four. I think they completely underestimated how competitive the Premier League is. I think the Premier League's never been more competitive, which is part of the problem. And then going into this season, you know, I think they were probably a little bit more realistic in knowing that they weren't going to be in the title picture. But I think they were hoping to be in the hunt for Champions League to bounce back in a positive direction. And it just hasn't happened. And the big question for me, really, as someone who covers the club, given that this is a private equity venture, given that this is all driven by a capitalist ideology, how long is the financial runway for this? You know, how long can... You've spent all this money on these players. How long can you sustain not being in Europe, underachieving to this degree on the pitch, before you have to start making decisions you don't want to make? And, you know, raising prices on fans, that's one thing. It's not going to get you any, it's not going to make you any more beloved than you already are, but it's also not going to make a huge difference financially to your bottom line. Do you get to a point where you have to consider selling a few of the success stories, or as fans are more immediately concerned right now, whether you have to sell homegrown products to pay for these players that you've signed at great expense who by and large haven't delivered amazing returns yet. So I think there's already a movement among the match going supporters, you know, wearing t-shirts saying, if you sell Connor, we riot. Connor Gallagher, he's obviously asset number one. If you were looking at players they might have to raise money from this summer, Trevor Chalobah has kind of been shopped around for a while, not by himself, but by the club. And so I think fans see that, and that's worrying them too. But how long can Chelsea's owners really sustain this before they have to start deviating from the plan that they've implemented here?
Yeah, which brings me naturally onto PSR, and I feel like every podcast now feels like it needs to have a PSR caveat to it. But yeah, I mean, Liam, where are the club's finances at this moment in time? We've seen those very long contracts and all that kind of stuff. And you're talking about, you know, players potentially having to be sold in the summer. Yet again, disruption to what could be, you know, an in-sync team or a team still getting to know itself.
Yeah, so they passed PSR for this year, which is why there were no waves of Premier League announcing investigations or anything. We believe it was fairly narrow. You know, we don't get to know that. That isn't made public, but we believe they were fairly narrowly compliant. Next year was always going to be the one that most people were projecting Chelsea to have problems with, because they won't have Champions League income on their accounts. They've got all this expense from last summer on the books, and so it matters how much they raise from player sales. And we don't know exactly, we can't know the precise picture from the outside, we can't see Chelsea's accounts, but most of the informed projections are that they might need to raise as much as 100 million. Now, if you ask Chelsea, they insist that's not the case, but you know, they would insist that's not the case, because if you do need to sell players, the last thing you want is other clubs knowing you need to sell players by June 30th, because it completely kneecaps your negotiating position. But I think that probably informs the fact that there hasn't been any real conversation, any serious conversation about renewing Conor Gallagher's contract. He'll have a year left. That's why he's such a natural candidate to be sold. We know that these academy players are pure profit. They are the easiest way for not any club, not just Chelsea, to dig themselves out of a PSR hole. And so the month of June could be very interesting at Chelsea, shall we say, in terms of outgoings. But the bigger picture worry, I think, is whether they meet those requirements, whatever scale of sales that they need, whether they meet those requirements or not. I think the bigger picture is that how much scope will they have to actually improve this squad? You know, despite the investment, this squad needs improvement if they want to compete near the top of the Premier League. It may require more significant investment, as ludicrous as that sounds, in order to ensure that next season's a different story. But will they have the ability to do that? Or are they kind of locked in at the moment to this group, which remains very raw in a lot of places and very flawed in certain areas?
Yeah, I'm just looking at Chelsea's next match against Manchester United. 8 points between both teams, Tim. Simon Johnson in the Straight Out of Cobham podcast seems to think European football is completely out of their grasp for this season. But I'm just thinking in terms of all the negativity around the Bowley, Clear Lake sort of consortium. Even if Chelsea manage by some miracle to get the Conference League, that would be great PR. Just to say, look, we told you something's working.
Maybe. Although, you know, talk about a falls from grace, Io. that's some PR move.
I'm clinging to straws here, as you can see.
Yeah, I don't know, really. I'm not sure. To say that in Europe, I guess, sounds good, but in reality, do they really want to be in the Conference League next season? You know, I'm not sure how much that would matter, to be honest. But then again, you know, they've gone without Europe this season. I really thought that would be a big thing for Chelsea this season, having free midweeks, not having European football and all the complications that come with that should surely help their Premier League form. But it just hasn't at all. It's a very watchable game, I've got to say, against Man United. I'm keen to watch every Chelsea and Man United game at the moment because there's just carnage afoot every time they play.
I mean, I'm not a betting man, but I think over 15 shots for both teams is a pretty safe one.
But this is the question, though. Why is Thiago Silva not playing right now? I mean, I know he's been injured, but... Yeah, if we talk about, let's just focus on this season alone, let's just focus on potentially Chelsea climbing this league table. Why is an experienced player like him not playing, Tim?
There's obviously more reasons to this than just football reasons, because when you look at just the nature of the goals that they're conceding at the moment, it's quite farcical, to be honest. You know, they could really do with his experience and his nous in there, whether it's to do with an issue with Pochettino or with his missus, I don't know. Liam can shed more light, but you need him in there, especially for a big game away against Manchester United.
Well, Bel Silver said it herself during the Wolves game. It was time for a change, and Pochettino made one. And Silver, I mean, he's had an injury as well, a groin injury, but that's not the reason he's not playing now. We haven't directly asked Pochettino about it, and I think the reason why it hasn't been a bigger talking point is that Chelsea weren't a good defensive team when Silva was playing either. It is one that people can now latch onto because he's not in the team and because he's one of the few experienced heads. But when you look at the goals that Chelsea are conceding, it's not just about the defenders. They don't defend from the front well enough. Their pressing is not as good as it was early in the season. Teams get through it. I've spoken about their midfield energy, how it waxes and wanes. There are issues with the way they're set up where Moises Caicedo can just be incredibly isolated and far too easy to play around because he's got too much ground to cover. And then you have defenders who I think, while they're all individually talented, you know, Benoit Badiashile, he can go through 70 minutes and be a really impressive figure to watch. And then he makes one incredible mental mistake per match. And that seems to be, I mean, maybe that's inevitable with younger players. Maybe it's an issue with the structure or what they're being asked to do. But, you know, you had the Desassione goal against Leicester. You've got Chelsea regularly make mistakes where they just don't track people. There's a really big issue that has been the case all season. This is another thing that can be directed at Pochettino, I think, with set pieces. you know, they nearly conceded two goals to Burnley from set pieces, despite the fact that they had big numerical advantages both times. They give up free headers. They don't track runners. They're not the biggest, most physical team, which doesn't help, but there's a sense that they could be better organised. And they just switch off. They don't do the little things that you need to do in order to be a good defensive team. And there's, you know, there's maybe even a sense that they don't enjoy defending enough. They don't relish it as a team. They haven't set that culture. And that, again, is maybe something you can look to Pochettino for.
Right, let's end it there, gents. Thanks so much for your time, Liam and Tim. And do not forget to rate and review the podcast. It really does help the podcast get listened to by so many other people. And also, thank you so much for listening. We're back tomorrow.
The Athletic.